Welcome, everyone, to a special edition of the Gray Company podcast. My name is Derek, and on this sub-episode, we're going to be talking about our first impressions for the first pack in the Ringmaker cycle, the newly released Dunlin Trap. Ian has just had his first child. I almost said he birthed his first child, but that wouldn't even be close to the truth. but he has had his first kid, and we congratulate him, and we wish him the best. He will be back with us when we record our next full episode. But for now, it's just three of the Gray Company, and with me as well is Dan and Matthew. So, Matthew, how are you doing today?
Pretty good. I got to play the Dunlin Trap yesterday at my local game store, and so I'm excited to talk about it. Other than that, my summer school class that I was teaching ended on Friday, so my summer's looking a little bit more free, so I'm looking forward to more time to get to play Lord
of
the Rings.
Awesome. How much time do you actually have off before you're back to the old grind?
School starts back up right after Gen Con, Okay. So late August, cool. I believe. Yeah.
And Dan, what's new down there in your neck of the woods?
Not much. It is getting ungodly hot, so it keeps me inside, and I get to play some cards. But yeah, I picked up Dunlin on Thursday, and I finally got the chance to play it Friday night. So it'll be good to...
With your fancy sleeves.
Yeah, those are great sleeves. If you haven't seen them yet, go on our Facebook page and check out Dan's awesome sleeves.
Funny to see the love/hate that I get for those. Some people really enjoyed them, and other people thought it was a sin against all things Tolkien. So.
You mean there weren't?
I'd be in the latter.
You mean there weren't unicorns in the Lord of the Rings?
Hey, I think it's good not to take yourself too seriously.
It's good.
I'm a slave to theme, Dan. Those sleeves are unacceptable.
You're a slave to theme. Wait. We need to mark this down.
Yeah, write it down.
A date and a, you know, like this Matthew.
When it comes to unicorns and rainbows,
Matthew just said he's a slave to theme.
If there's one thing we've learned over the course of this podcast, it's that Matthew is all about the theme. He's about the pure art decks.
Yeah. He has his all Magali deck, right?
That's why I like your new search feature on Hall of Bjorn.
That's awesome.
Oh, you are trolling me so hard right now. It's amazing.
Geez.
Well, speaking of that search feature, I've got the cards pulled up here on hallofbjorn.com for all of you kids at home. And looking at the quest, the setup cards, the quest cards, we learn a little bit about where the direction that this cycle is going to take us. And we've already gotten a lot of input on that because all of the packs have been previewed and spoiled. But in this first quest, the heroes are leaving Isengard. They just delivered Mugash back to Saruman. He sends him on the way to Tharbad, which if you go ahead and pull out your Middle Earth maps and look that up. And on the way, they get waylaid by, you guessed it, a trap set by the Dunlendings.
It's a trap.
It's a trap. So let's just get right into it. What were you guys' kind of first impressions getting into the quest?
I'll jump in. The first time I played it, I got completely and utterly crushed. I did not read ahead. I didn't, I just picked a deck and ran with it and got stomped. So it was an interesting experience. It really, especially the first two stages, were really different than just about any other scenario in the game, I would say.
I always look at the cards before we play. The thing is, I forget half of them anyway, but I did remember that your allies and some of your attachments go away, but that didn't change any of our decks. So my buddy Matt from Tucson drove up, and he only has, a deck or two made, and my other buddy Michael, who's local in town, we didn't change his decks either. So knowing that we'd be losing some of our equipment in this quest was interesting. Really, all I said was, hey dudes, we're going to lose some of our allies, so that's going to happen. But I didn't feel that knowing that really affected the way I was going to play. At one point, I played Faramir. I was like, well, he's going to be the one that I keep, But it didn't change us too much, I think, knowing that particular stage. We lost it as we were playing three-player, obviously. We lost it the first time. I don't really remember why we lost it, but I'm pretty sure that we did. The second time, though, we won, and it was an interesting quest, for sure. Definitely different.
Yeah, and one thing you were saying kind of pregame is when you're setting this quest up and you pull out the other sets that go into the quest from the Voice of Isengard big box, the ones that you get from the big box are significantly smaller than the actual set that comes with the pack. And so it's really more about this particular quest, but also the... Okay, well, where I'm going with this is this. I was surprised because I knew that this quest messed with your hand and your hand size, or I thought it did anyway. And so when I realized that that card with the crow on it, it was Ill Tidings, is that the one? Wasn't going in, I was surprised. But then as you kind of play it out and you see which Dunlendings get put in and then those conditions attachments that go on the actual quest and how they combo with the locations in this particular quest, you kind of see how the pieces start to come together, which obviously I realized too late because I got crushed my first time too.
Yeah, I thought it combo... I mean, again, I like smaller encounter decks. This was a recent discussion on the FFG forums. I would say I prefer them because I think the encounter deck is tighter and it's more effective, and player decks are getting more effective, I think, by and large, or at least more powerful. But yeah, it was much more about not the number of cards in your hand, yeah, per se, like the Voice of Isengard cards. You're right. It was much more about simply drawing a card.
Yeah, card draw,
which
hate.
Made a lot of these things really, yeah, right, really, really daunting.
And I would...
I just want to say I got to give kudos to the designers because I really like that one of the locations that you can go to for kind of like, you know, a breather from all the card draw hate is actually makes it so you don't draw during the resource phase, which I thought was genius because under the circumstances, that's actually like, oh, okay, good. I don't need to, like, my guys aren't going to get shadow cards and extra shadow cards and this guy's not going to get buffed and, you know, like, you can actually use something that would really be, in any other scenario, terrible. Like, why would you ever travel to a location that keeps you from drawing? But, in fact, there is that exact same location in past scenarios, and you would basically Astaloth it and never go there. And in this one, you would actually choose to go there, which is it was a really nice kind of twist the designers did there, where you would, you know, it's sometimes the right strategic call to go to that location.
You know, although what we found in our game was, in that the ones you're talking about is Plains of Innidwaith. I'm looking at the cards here, but we would always go to, I don't even want to pronounce it, the one that would let us draw two cards, because all of the, because it wasn't really about hand size for most of these. Most of them said when a player draws any number of cards. Yeah. So we actually found that one to be more, one, it has a higher threat. It also has more quest points, but we found drawing two cards to be more beneficial because, well, if we have to draw any number of cards, we want to draw two because that gives us more options, especially when we lost all of our stuff. And so, I mean, your point well taken. It does give you a respite if you need it, but I almost wish that, you know, the stream, which is the one that where you draw two, if these things had triggered off how many cards you drew, but it didn't. So I thought that was the more beneficial location, all things being equal, as opposed to the plains.
Yeah, my second time through, I actually did not travel to, is it the stream? No, the stream is where you draw two. Where is Plains?
Yep.
Plains is where you don't draw, yeah.
Yep.
I actually didn't travel there, I just ended up Astalothing it, because it's only got two points.
Right.
But,
it's right. The art is pretty on that card, though.
Yeah, the landscapes on this quest are great.
Yeah, they really are.
It's shocking seeing a card with two quest points, though, honestly, because, like, ever since, Astaloth has kind of, like, changed the metagame where they don't really make locations with anything less than three quest points anymore, it seems
like. Yeah, I mean, I guess because he gets lost, you know, gets taken away after the one quest stage, maybe they thought, well, maybe you wouldn't have him back or something. I don't know, but you're right, it is a little odd.
One thing I did notice that is that the card draw effects can be pretty sneaky. Because the first time when it asks you to choose a Boar Clan enemy to engage with, I chose the Boar Clan Stalker. I'm like, oh, he's three threat. I can just have that engage with me and not worry about it. He's got zero attack, zero defense. Five hit points is kind of a lot. But then you don't realize how sneaky it can be. Because by the time, like, turn two, he's already got two resource tokens on him. So he's, you know, a two attack, two defense. And pretty soon, especially because the deck I was playing wasn't very good, it was more of a support deck that I'd played for our last group game. That guy gets hard to take down, and so when
he does, I was just gonna say, you gotta take him down early. He was always the one I took, regardless. But you're right; if he gets away from you, four attack, four defense, more than anything, it's pretty hard to crack.
Yeah, because that's five hit points, four defense. And then, you know, as the cards start coming off the encounter deck and they start surging and chaining with each other, you're gonna start drawing cards and you're gonna start putting more and more resource tokens on them. And then, of course, when you get to stage two and you go to the ravine, he's got that extra bonus. So that guy in particular can get a little bit out of hand.
Right. Yeah, he was a cool enemy. Yeah. Another thing that I would say, just sort of, we're getting sort of into it now, but an opening thing was The strategy note that I took a picture of from the rules insert and posted on our Facebook, man, is that thing absolutely accurate. It really has nothing to do with strategy per se, but it has to do with, hey, folks, slow down when you're playing this quest. And was that ever accurate? Because I enjoyed the quest overall, and I'm sure we'll talk about our overall impressions at the end, but what I didn't like was feeling that I was constantly missing something or having to be so meticulous, and it really slowed down the game. And I think part of it's just we've been playing the game for years. We feel like we know it and blaze through it. We know the cards, we know whatever, but this quest, you can't do that. You really have to look, especially in a three-player game, you've got to look, a four-player would be even worse. You have to look at each and every, you got to look at the encounter card, you got to look at the active location. You know, is it dependent on when it's active or in the staging area? Look at the staging area locations. Are they dependent on being active or staging? Look at all the enemies. So many things trigger when you draw a card or do something. It's very, very easy to miss stuff in this quest. I felt like more than any other quest that we have. And so I certainly thought that the designers telling us to, hey, be careful, be slow your first couple of times through was really spot on.
Yeah, and going back to your earlier comment, because the encounter deck is tighter, because it's more consistent, it's more likely that in any given playthrough, and I found this too, is that both of my playthroughs were actually very similar. The difference was not so much in even, like, I had a better draw in the first game where I got crushed than the second, but it's ultimately I had to adapt my strategy to the scenario, and that's how I was able to beat it. But to speak to your point, it's the odds that a lot of stuff in play have passives or forced or other effects that are triggering off of them, you know, especially like in the quest phase, for example. There's just a lot of stuff going on. And then you also have these kind of end of turn or end of combat phase, a lot of stuff going on depending on which stage of the quest you're in. So there's just the game state gets very complicated.
Yeah, it does. I remember my buddy Matt saying when we were playing it, maybe at the end, he said, man, sort of what you're saying is that this quest seems to have more strategic value, meaning the player decisions mattered a whole lot more than a lot of other quests where you just plop allies down and you willpower, as I often say, ready, willpower, go, or however I say it. But you did have to think about who's taking which enemies do we choose, where do we travel. It seemed to matter a whole lot more than the typical quest, and from that aspect, I found it more
enjoyable. Agree with you. I definitely, and again, I've only played a couple solo games so far. Tuesday's my game night, so I'll hopefully get to play with, you know, three or four handed on that night. But just in the games that I've played, I really felt like I was scratching my head a little bit more. Not just because I'm crunching numbers and I forgot my abacus, but because it felt like all the choices really mattered. And who am I going to send questing when I know I've got some guys engaged and I know they're going to get pumped up when I draw cards and da-da-da-da-da. So I think you're right in that definitely felt like there was more decision-making involved than the usual quest, which I hope is an indicator of where the cycle is going to go. Because, you know, I think Caleb and Matt have really kind of hit their stride. We saw some really great things with Black Riders. We saw some really cool things with Voice of Isengard. And hopefully they've kind of, you know, like I said, hit their stride, and we'll get to see lots of cool stuff and even more chances for important decision-making as the cycle goes on.
Yeah, one of the important decisions that I felt was different than Voice of Isengard had to do with the time mechanic. In Voice of Isengard, I felt like the timed effects were horrendous, and you never wanted them to go off. In this quest, it was like, meh, I lose my hand and draw two cards. While drawing two cards might not necessarily be the best thing for some of the enemies, they weren't as bad, and given the fact that they were inevitable, some of these quests have 18 points, quest points on them. There's no way, at least with the decks we were playing, and given the high threat of most of these enemies or locations, given the buffer of the active location, that we were going to be making 18 plus progress in a turn. So we knew that we would be triggering these most of the time, and it didn't matter much. And I'm not sure if that was their intent, that we know that these time effects are going to go off, but they're not that bad or not. But I found the time mechanic to be far less important on this particular quest than it was in Voice of Isengard, where I never wanted it to go off.
Yeah, I'm with you to a point, but it still definitely affects it, right? Because, like, let's take Stage 1, where, especially after playing through it once, and I realized, okay, Stage 2, I'm going to lose all my allies but one. And fortunately for my deck, the attachment thing didn't affect me at all because, I mean, Asphaloth would be the one card, but I actually drew him later, so it didn't really matter. But all the rest of my stuff was just conditions or, you know, had no trade at all, so it didn't get affected by that stage two. So the real thing I was looking at is I'm only going to have one ally. And the one, my one thought of how I could counteract that is I've got a lot of, you know, stuff like Timely Aid and A Very Good Tale, where if I could hold on to those guys for stage two, that would be my reset for, oh, I've only got one guy out. If I can pay for one more, that gets me at two. I can Very Good Tale, I can Timely Aid, yada, yada, yada. But the problem is you can't hold on to any specific card in your hand. And right. I also had the interesting thing where, you know, going to the one that lets you draw two, I used that to my advantage because I was able to, I used the strategy of always engage and then kill whatever enemy if possible, yeah, so that you're not like your Boar Clan Stalker isn't becoming a 4/4 if you just pull him down and kill him very quickly, and which is great. But the thing that I found is that you draw like cancellation, say, because, you know, I'm drawing the extra card from the location, right, and I'm actually hoping for a When Revealed to come up that turn, because I know that where the time counter is, unless I can plow through the quest this turn, I'm losing the Test of Will at the end of the round.
We had that a lot, too, where we would cancel stupid treacheries we wouldn't otherwise do or things because we knew we'd be losing our hand anyway. Yeah,
so I mean, to me, like, it does have an impact. I mean, it's interesting where you're like, I'm gonna do this, even though that's not something I would ever cancel because I'm losing the card at the end of the round. Or in my case, a lot of times what would happen is I would just end up discarding it because it would be an enemy or a location, and my Test of Will is just useless at that point. So it definitely had an impact.
No, I mean, it did. It just didn't seem as dramatic as they were in Voice of Isengard. Those seemed worse.
Absolutely not. There really are no game ending, with the exception of the last round, which is actually how you win. That's that time one obviously matters a lot, but the rest of them are not game ending.
And it seems like I don't know if this is what they were going for, but it seems like they were going for subtlety, because discarding your hand and drawing those two cards doesn't seem like a big deal, but if you have certain cards in play, it could become a big deal. Like if you've got that condition attachment that damages people, and if you've got the one where you end up putting somebody into play if you discard it. It's the Hills of Dunland, where if you draw a card, you discard the top card of the encounter deck. If it's an enemy, it comes into play with you. Right. So that could become a problem. But just even hearing you guys talk about it and discussing it with you, it seems like it's a very finely honed quest. Because Fight at the Fords, which I keep drawing comparisons to because it's basically the same quest, it's a battle with Dunlandings, was meant to feel like a battle. If the timer goes off, you got another wave, not just one enemy, but a wave of enemies coming at you. With this one, it feels a lot more subtle.
Yeah, it's like I don't know, skirmishes or something is this one, whereas that really was a true battle. It's a good point. The one thing that I want to add high level for anyone that out there that already has this and might be struggling with it, there's some cards that you really should look at, especially if you haven't in a while, is Protector of Lorien, both of the Trollshaw Scout and Watcher of the Bruinen. I totally recommend those guys, because when you're looking at a time counter that's about to go down in stage one, and so you know you're losing your hand, Protector of Lorien is a great example. Like if I've got three cards in my hand and I'm going to lose them and then draw two new ones, by all means, if you have nothing better to do with them, quest hard with one of your guys with Protector of Lorien and throw all three of those cards at him, because they're going away anyway, so you might as well get use out of them. And same thing with both of the Noldor, you know, tactics allies, where, like, being able to, you know, if you want to mow through a couple of these Dunlending guys, being able to have them not exhaust to defend or on the counterattack is really nice, because those cards are going away, so you might as well get a use out of them. And so, same thing with Eowyn, actually. Sorry, I just wanted to throw that in there as well. Eowyn as a hero is a great call for this quest.
Yeah, she's just great in general for getting rid of uniques, and I've been using her, or buddies have been using her consistently. We also played the Khazad-dûm Nightmare yesterday after we beat this quest, and so I'm going to sort of talk about it only briefly, but my buddy Matt brought up Mighty Prowess as a way to deal with those damn orcs that get resources, because in a two-player game, I've beaten it. Three-player was a whole nother story. But he brought up Mighty Prowess last night, and thinking about it, I think it would be nice in these quests, too.
Totally, yeah.
Because everything's a Dunlending, or a Boar Clan or something, and so Aemir with Firefoot, where the excess is going anyway, plus you get to do the Mighty Prowess. It's a card we didn't use, because we didn't think about it, but it's not an item, and it's not a mount, and so it's something
that
would stick around. Yeah, I think
that
would be a good card. And that gets back to my point of, you know, we talked about this pre-show, was each player discards each item and each mount attachment he controls, and we were all like, what the hell's an item? And so I pulled up Dan's card search because it didn't affect all three of us. The mounts did. We lost Firefoot. We lost Rohan Warhorse. But I was like, what are items? And there's actually, I think there was 18 cards, if I remember correctly, that are items. But they weren't like Blade of Gondolin, Citadel Plate might have been one. I don't remember all of them, and it's not important. But the fact of the matter was, it wasn't a lot of stuff. I almost would have preferred it if they really wanted to mess with us, losing all attachments. Because I've been playing with Elodan and Elro here again lately, and I'd forgotten how good they are. I would say that they are, whichever one's the defender, I can't remember their name. Sorry, I'm not really a fan of lore. That he's better than Baragon, bar none. Bar none, because it is so much easier to have him do multiple defenses definitely. Than Baragon. And I slap all the Dunedain, I make him warning Sentinel, I boost up his defense, and he is just a boss. And I'd forgotten, because he came out so early in Khazad Dûm, but he stayed a superhero the entire time, because none of his attachments went away, which I felt was sort of like, I get why it's a trap, the Dunedain steal our stuff, but it didn't affect enough kinds of attachments, I didn't think, for it really to be meaningful. Again, we didn't really lose anything.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, well, I can see how this might hurt, but not enough attachments are actually...
I lost my cram. Womp womp. But to take a quick lore sidestep, I think it says in the books that really nobody can tell Elodan and Elro here apart except for their family.
Oh, really?
They don't feel bad about it.
Nice.
I don't feel bad at all. See, I'm a slave to lore. I don't even know who's this.
Yeah, you're a slave to lore. I mean, high level to get a sense of what's going to go away, all the weapons and armor are items, and then as far as, like, you know...
Oh, yeah, we lost the spear. That was annoying.
Commonly used uniques that are Celebrian Stone's an item, Horn of Gondor's an item. So, I mean, there's some good stuff you're going to lose, but... Honestly, there's also a lot of stuff. I mean, it was funny, like you, Matthew, there's a lot of cards I don't even think about what the trait is on an attachment because I don't really care. You know, I mean, if it's not a trap, for example, like there's certain traits where it really matters because Anborn actually interacts with that. But, you know, looking at Resourceful and realizing there's no trait on that card. So I was like, sweet, it stays.
It should have been the same. I mean, again, it's hard to handicap it, but if they wanted it to be harder, maybe they didn't. But each player discards each attachment he controls except one, just like allies.
That would have been much more brutal.
Or maybe leave one per hero or something. Each hero can keep one attachment. I mean, man, that would really change how stage two goes. That would have been a very well laid trap. As it is now, Dunlendings didn't get very much.
No, they're wild heathens. They don't know how to lay a trap. But I will also say
they're looking for the mithril loincloth.
Oh, mithril loincloth.
But I will say that this is a good quest. In my limited experience, for chump blockers, because you've got some heavy hitters in terms of your enemies, and you've got Frenzied Attack, which is a treachery that forces you to discard an ally, and of course you're going to lose your allies at stage two. But there were many a Citadel. What's the poor Gondorian intern?
Oh, the one who gets your resource.
The little intern.
Yeah.
Oh, Squire of the Citadel.
There were many a Squire of the Citadel who lost their lives to this.
I gotta give huge props to whoever did the art on that card, because the more that I use it, the more it just cracks me up. Like, I hold on, I gotta do a shout out here, because that's...
You just kind of picture him, like, leaving Minas Tirith, like, I'm going on an adventure.
He's got this, like wide-eyed, innocent, you know, smile on his face, and, like, Anna Steinbauer. Props to you, Anna Steinbauer, because you get it. Like, that, the look on this guy, this poor kid's face, he looks like he's all of 15 years old, and he's, like, weighed down with, like, the knight's sword and a big heavy pack, and he's got, like, pots and pans and stuff. And you can just see that he's all excited. This is my first day of battle, and he's just going to go out there to get slaughtered. It's awesome.
You know, now that I'm looking at this card that you mentioned, I was like, I don't remember discarding allies. I'm reading it, and I don't remember if we played it correctly. Frenzied Attack. Each player draws a card. We did that. Each player discards each ally from his hand.
You're such a cheater.
I think we only discarded one ally.
You're such a cheater.
Which would make a huge difference. I don't remember.
Man, I lost
or
like
Michael,
four...
feel free to comment in the comments if I'm misremembering. But
we definitely
discarded an ally. And I control the encounter deck when we play, which is why I try not to do it online. So that means I'm reading the cards. I think we totally screwed
I've lost
that up,
all respect for
horrible.
You, Matthew. I've lost all respect
well,
for you.
Well, this goes back to the comment that a viewer posted, or a listener, I should say, posted. How do you guys remember stuff? Sometimes we just don't.
Yeah.
And I think I totally misread this.
My first playthrough, I lost 4 allies to that card. It was like, because my deck runs some expensive allies because of all the shenanigans I do, and I think I lost like Gildor and Haldir and, you know, like a Master of the Forge and Glaowine or some craziness, like 4 freaking cards, because I drew Gildor off of the effect of the card and then lost all the allies in my hand. It was so brutal.
Yeah, that one's almost like a spit in the eye. Like, go ahead and draw a card. Oh, you drew Gandalf? Sorry.
Yeah. I actually really like that they add the card draw, because not only is it like, here's another card that you're about to discard, but, oh, by the way, if there's a dude engaged with you, he just got buffed.
Yeah.
Insult to injury.
Whoops. Sawgrove. I messed that up.
But one thing you said, Dan, pre-show, that I will not take credit for, because you're our... eye in the sky, and as you like to say, high level. But just, it really did seem like the designers were going for the metagame in this sense, like you're talking about, just with the card draw stuff and discarding and all that stuff. It's, again, much like Fight at the Fords, it's a very meta kind of scenario.
Yeah, I'm really encouraged by that, and what you guys were saying about like it bodes well. I agree. I think the Ringmaker cycle, not only in terms of player cards, assuming you like elves, but in terms of scenarios, I think it's going to be a very good cycle.
Well, shall we move on to player cards, or do we want to do kind of a general impressions about the quest itself before we do that?
Yeah, let's do general impressions, and I will say that, as I echo an earlier comment, that this quest was stressful, but not in the way the Black Riders quests were stressful, in a fun way, in that it was tense with these Nazgul and whatever else. This one was stressful from a mechanical point of view, in that I was always worried about missing an effect going off, and that wasn't very fun. And this game is certainly getting more and more and more complex, as I think in a way it has to, because we can't go back to the old school passage through Mirkwood or even Journey along the Anduin just willpowering or chumping or attacking. And so, you know, we have to have things triggering off each other. But in a 3-player game, I can't even imagine a 4-player game, there's too much to keep track of. The second thing I thought was that the end of the quest was very, very anticlimactic. It was just like, oh, so I chumped the one enemy engaged with me with my Errand Rider. And, oh, so none of my heroes got a single point of damage, and the same with all my buddies, so we win? That seems really dumb. Like, I felt like we almost should have killed the chief. Now, certainly, I won't spoil it. You got to read the story at the end, and it did explain it, but it made the end of the quest kind of just blah. It's like you build up, you have 5 times the number of players or time counters, so it takes a little bit of time to get rid of that, and then you're like, wait, all I got to do is chump block this? Are you kidding me? And so, I don't know. I like the quest overall. I think I need to play it a few more times to know if I really like it. I said the exact same things to my buddies yesterday. I was like, I don't know if I like this quest or not. It's a lot of paying attention. It's a lot of mental work. It makes you tired after you play it mentally. And then you don't kill the boss. You just chump some enemies. You don't even attack them back. You just have to survive. And I felt that there was a better way to implement that if they really wanted it to be possible to lose. Because we had, what, 15, 20 time counters to rebuild back up our army? That was a really long time, and so all we had to do was chump block, and I just didn't find it, I don't know, all that challenging.
Well, I wonder, too, I don't know, I can't give a number, but like it seems like a pretty small percentage of the quests that we've done have like a really satisfying ending. Like that's something where when I'm teaching somebody this game, we get to stage 3, yeah. 4, 5, we win. They're like, that's it? We won? Yeah, we won. Let's all clap and cheer. You know what I mean? Like, there's not really a good way to, you know.
The Morgul Vale ending is.
Well,
great,
I'm saying there are some real winners, but in general, like just from a mechanical, like meta, whatever you want to call it, standpoint,
right,
there's not really a lot of hoopla when you win in this game. And I think with this particular quest, it's interesting in that it's so different. Like, it's just to survive. You don't even have to kill anybody. You just hold out until time goes down and make sure your heroes don't die. So I wonder if that. Is almost more of like a narrative perspective, and that they're trying to do something in terms of storytelling, or if it's just they wanted to change it up.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, look at the inserts in the pack, right? We know that they're doing something narratively, and I don't think it's a coincidence that this boss is completely unkillable, even though he's some random Dunlending dude, because obviously there's a narrative reason why. But
I guess I've never thought about it from that perspective. I mean, killing Ungoliant Spawn and Passage Through Mirkwood, if you get that one, that's the one I always want. I hate the just the progress one, but you're right. I mean, I guess if I thought about it, unless it's a boss enemy quest, perhaps we do have rather anticlimactic endings.
See,
I don't know. It seems hollow because it was just survive.
It's not that simple to me. Like I'm with you to a point, but let me give a counter argument for where it could still be exciting. Is that like I love Into Ithilien, and it's funny because I hated that quest when it first came out because I was coming at it from a very, like you said, traditional ready willpower go perspective. And if you if you enter that quest with that perspective, you will be utterly and totally destroyed. So first of all, it makes you rethink how you play the game. But I really like the ending of the quest, actually, which would sound weird because it's not a boss fight. But the thing that I like is at every point of the way, to me, that quest feels tense. And even the ending, like, I don't take it as a given. Like, I want to rush through that siege, the last step where it's, unless you really luck out and have a low threat, it's your threat's low, raising, each player's is raising by, like, 3 a turn at the end of that. And if any one player is above a certain point, it's a siege quest. So, like, it's tricky. And at that point, you've been kind of, like, you know, probably whittled down by all the other stages, and so you're like, okay, I just want to rush through this thing, and I don't want to get blocking wargs, and I don't want to get, God forbid, Watcher in the Woods or whatever, where everyone raises their threat by 20. So it's not like a given that you're going to win. You basically like have to rush the end of it just to not take too many turns to have a chance of getting one of those terrible treacheries. And so to me, like, that's a good example of a quest where you don't have to have a boss enemy, and it can still feel, and it feels so satisfying when you beat Into Ithilien. It really does. Like, even down to the last.
I've been scared of that one. I haven't played it in so long.
It's a terrifying quest. Like, and the thing that it does, and I'll bring this back to Dunland Trap because there are similarities there to me, is that there are so many different ways it challenges you, right? So you can say, like, oh, it's a siege quest. Okay, I'm just going to quest with all my guys that have high defense. Well, that's great, but then there's these freaking Haradrim that attack when they come into play. So even if you somehow manage to get to stage 4 with low threat, they're going to attack you from the staging area, and they have, I want to say it's like 3 or 4 attack, and the shadows in that set are, and the shadows in that set are nasty, so like they could kill a hero easily from the staging area. So if you're sending everybody, you're totally opening yourself, so like you don't necessarily want to do that. But on the other hand, if, you know, like I said, if you take too many rounds, stuff like blocking wargs is going to, like, you know, losses by attrition, you're just going to start losing your defenders of Ramas and your winged guardians and all the dudes that are cheap and have the high defense to do the siege questing. So, like, you're kind of, there's this urgency, but then at the same time, if you send everybody, you get Watcher in the Woods and it raises your threat by 20 and you lose. So, there's this, like, crazy balance you kind of have to ride. And honestly, I felt in the parts of Dunland Trap that I really liked, I felt the exact same way. Like, you really have to find that sweet spot in the middle where you're not, like, overcommitting and you're leaving guys back to deal with the combat and all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, we found we didn't want to go too quickly through the first stage because we sort of wanted to get our heroes established. But, you know, you're probably right. Although I will say that I remember there's a lot of new players on the forums or BGG or where have you will ask, wait, I can win when enemies are engaged with me? That doesn't seem right. You just run past them saying na 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 boo boo, you know. And I think that that's, you know, that's how this quest felt. Because in theory, because I had a huge army built up by the time the 15 time counters went off, you know, I literally probably had 8 or 10 allies back in play. So losing my previous allies didn't hurt me in any way, shape, or form. Maybe I would have had 20 allies instead of the 10 that I had. But it was like, oh, really? I chump with this one person? That's what we all did. We just chumped one or two enemies that were engaged with us, and we won. And it just seemed so cheap. I would have preferred the other quest where you have to kill all enemies and play.
They maybe should have put shadow effects that instead of just buffing, because there's a lot of buffing shadow effects, and there's like some crazy ones based on cards and stuff, and there's even some chaining shadow. But none of them ever penalized you for chumping. I think this quest would be interesting if there were shadow effects that say, you know, if the defending character dies from this attack, deal 2 damage to a hero. Like, okay, suddenly, I'm thinking a little bit more carefully about chumping.
Man, you guys are just sadistic.
Because there's some risk here.
No, well, but at the same time, though, if the whole point is heroes can't die, there's never a single threat to a hero if you can chump block. And you're right, Dan. There's other quests where they punish you for chumping, and this one doesn't. My heroes probably didn't have if there was archery damage, which would have made this quest way more complicated. But, you know, there was nothing that, in theory, always had to to affect heroes.
So
there needed to be something that put your heroes in peril,
so,
because nothing does.
So going back to Into Ithilien then, like, that's where, to me, that quest is so good, is that blocking wargs is every bit as bad as a shadow card as it was as a when revealed, I contend. And the reason why is some of the best allies for that quest are Defender of Ramas and Winged Guardian. Well, both of those guys have one hit point, and there's a lot of 3 and 4 attack enemies, in some cases 5, depending on the quest stage, but you're either siege questing with those guys, or which means they're going to get hit by the one revealed on blocking wargs, or you're blocking these nasty enemies so that you actually have a hero for a counterattack. But in that case, blocking wargs as a shadow is every bit as bad, because then you've got a 4 or 5 strength attack that the defender dies to the shadow card, and now you're taking that undefended to a hero.
Yeah.
So, like, that's where that quest really makes you think, and the decisions are, like, very, very important, all the decisions. Whereas you're right, in this one, the one drawback, I would say, is that you can chump with impunity. Like, by all means, stash a bunch of squires at the Citadel. That's actually one of the really funny things about the way he's worded, is it's after he leaves play, it's not after he dies, which is awesome, because in stage 2, if you have a bunch of, like, squires in play, and it's like, oh no, we got to stage 2, I discard all my squires, okay, pile a bunch of resources on my hero.
And it also comes back down to scaling, because playing solo, I only had 5... you know, less than 5 turns to kind of rebuild after that stage 2 shift. And so at a certain point, I was engaged with so many Dunlendings that my chump blockers are just dying off one by one, and it ends up falling onto the heroes anyway, especially with the big guy. Now, again, it would have been better if I had been able to take those guys out, which comes back to deck building, but, you know, not having the time or the resources to necessarily build back up any kind of army playing solo, cost me the game.
Yeah. And this is, Matthew's absolutely right. I played it the same way. I would totally recommend spending some time in the first stage, which seems weird because it's like, well, every other turn I'm losing my hand. Granted, that's where it goes back to use those cards efficiently with Eowyn and, you know, Protector of Lorien, etc., etc. But the thing that I really did in the early rounds is I stored up a ton of resources. And because, you know,
to lose those too. That's the other thing. We should have had to lose everything. You're gonna steal my Asphaloth in the one out of 1,000 cards that's an item, but you're not gonna steal all my gold. Although the story tells us you're stealing my gold.
We
should have had to lose resources.
Because resources are some abstract concept. They're not actually money. But
still, the point is if it. It doesn't hamper us enough, I don't
think.
Well,
you should submit the Nightmare version of this, then.
I'm sure the Nightmare version... Matt, if you're listening, because you designed the Nightmare quest, I'm sure you will take all of these things into consideration, because it could have hampered us more. Everyone loses everything
said,
but once.
Yeah.
You lose all resources but one, all attachments but one, all
I'm
one.
I'm totally with this alternate version of this, and, you know, honestly, I might even just house rule and try it out, because the thing to me, high level, is I really like this quest, even though we're getting into the nitty gritty and we're kind of knocking it, and I'm comparing it unfavorably to Into Ithilien. I still really like this quest, and I think the biggest reason why I do is it is so punishing to the current metagame that most solid decks, most top tier decks are. Every single case, this scenario does something to kind of subvert that. And granted, on the resource side, so it doesn't have resource punishment. That maybe is one oversight, but to me, still, like, the losing all your allies but one stage 2 is an amazing twist it does to your strategy. Yeah. Because the idea
it messes up outlands.
I dare someone to. And it's funny that our last episode we were talking about, you know, what's the one deck to rule them all? I would love to watch a YouTube video of someone playing Outlands deck against this scenario.
Right. The issue then for me is, while I agree 100%, I love that this messes with the metagame, it's quests that mess with the metagame. So not every quest is going to do this. So we'll eventually get to a quest where Outlands or Dwarves, remember, is just fine again. And that's, I don't know. I almost wish they could... I don't want to say I want them neutered, but the same strategy shouldn't work for everything except for a given cycle that focuses on
everything. Well, maybe the ally hate's going to continue. Yeah. I honestly hope it does, because to me, like, there's a combination of cards at this point that I think is I would call it an archetype in and of itself, and this is a topic for another episode, but I'm just going to, like, lay out what those cards are and leave it as an exercise to the listeners to fill in the gaps. But you just look at cards like Very Good Tale, Timely Aid, even if you're spending 4 on that, because, I don't know, leadership, I hear, can get resources. Elfstone, Now with the Sylvan stuff like tree people or people of the trees, or I think it's the tree people.
The tree people.
Tree people. Yeah. Thank you. There's one other that I'm thinking of. Oh no, sneak attack. So you just look at those cards. They only cover two spheres. The cards that I just named, and you stick some combination of those cards in a deck with good allies and good allies out of sphere. Like, I couldn't even tell you the number of times I've dropped Ally Bjorn in a leadership lore deck without paying for him.
Yeah.
And just wrecked shop. Like, in this scenario, I ended up doing that the first time through, even though I lost. Like, Ally Bjorn was just eating Dunlendings left and right because I timely aided him out first turn. And that combination of cards, like, there is ridiculous ally mustering you can do in this game.
Yeah, there is.
Well, there you have it.
Well, what do you think of it, Derek? Dan and I have been rambling on forever, and honestly, jury is still out. I think I like it, but I want to play it a few more times, especially since I'm not sure I played Frenzied Attack right. And I sent my buddies a Facebook message mid-show saying, "Sorry guys, I think I messed this one up."
Now they're never going to want to play with you again. No, I enjoyed it, especially like I was saying earlier. I really liked bearing witness to how the deck comboed with itself very clearly. I think, again, playing solo, I was able to do that because you're playing three-handed. There's so much going on that can be a lot more difficult to kind of keep up with and go along with. But I'm going to stay with you, Matthew, in the fact that I've only played it a couple times. I've only played it solo. So after I get in a couple multiplayer games, I'll have my full review prepared. My wife said she'd play this one with me, so I'm going to get some really strong decks together because she does not like to lose, so... Outlands all the way.
Nice.
But let's move on and let's talk about the player cards for a minute here. Any cards in particular tickled your fancy?
The jury on the forums, I think, is and other places, BGG, what have you, was underwhelming.
Haters gonna hate.
That seems to be the comment. That seems to be the comment. The theme, and part of it's Stewards Fear was Outlands. So here, Celeborn, I tried to make an elf deck. Dan, again, I do use your card search thing. I search for every Sylvan thing. And the problem is, the Sylvan stuff we have, there's some stuff sprinkled in Spirit, which would actually combo well with Celeborn and the Nath Guide and what have you. They're not all in the same sphere. And really, the only benefit you're getting is the first round, they get +1 stats. And it's like, for a round, it might be good. But unless you can find a way to repeatedly get that. So to me, I don't think Sylvan's there yet. Firefoot didn't stay on the table long enough for this particular quest for us to see if he was actually worth it. I don't think he did. I don't think he actually ever went off. So that was an issue. A Fall of Gil-galad, I'm just underwhelmed 100%. Limit one per deck, you're never going to draw it.
And the whole idea of playing to lose a hero is just weird to me, but whatever.
I mean, the thing is, it doesn't
trigger
enough
with Kaldara, right? Because Kaldara is discarded.
No, she's a discard. Right. So it's you legitimately have to lose the hero.
I don't know, what about... never mind. I already got my... had to put my foot in my mouth on Twitter because I suggested Bjorn. Like, you can't have attachments. So...
Yeah,
right.
And there's that.
Traders, interesting. You know, Ithilien Lookout, perhaps. And the Tree People's a good card, just it's not good yet. So to me, at this point, Ithilien Lookout is interesting, even for the regular 3 cost. And White Council, which we put in decks, but we never drew it to use it, or it was too expensive in 3-player games. So it's like 3 resources, I need an ally at this point, or I need something else, so we didn't use it, but... Those are the 2 most interesting. So it's a smattering, which I like, because this cycle is all about a smattering of different traits and reinforcing different stuff. But at the same time, it means that this pack doesn't bolster any one deck.
And I don't know if I'm more excited by these because they're more interesting and less practical, but I don't know. I really dug these. Any card that provides multiplayer interaction, like Blue Mountain Trader or the White Council, I really enjoy.
Right.
But again, I haven't got to try those.
I do too.
Out yet, so they could be totally useless.
The trader is going to be good. I'm calling it right now, and I'm sure there's other people that see it as well. But I mean, just anything that costs 2 and has the dwarf trait, first of all, is playable.
Yeah, he's a solid ally.
But
even just statistically.
But the ability is actually really freaking good, and it's. I think we're going to see more. I now actually.
I mean, it's Errand Rider if you don't have leadership.
Well,
I mean,
sure, but Errand Rider out of Spirit essentially because you know you can use it it as a way to either send it to other people or have it sent to you. It's honestly if you're the one including it in your deck and you happen to be running Dane or someone else's, it's way better than Aaron Rodgers, because you're giving someone, you know, an ally with two willpower, essentially for the cost of one. But it's like, you're obviously not going to, well, unless you're a jerk, you're not going to send it if they can't spare the resource. But it's basically, the ability never ends up being bad, because you use it when it's useful, and then they get an ally that is actually quite good. I mean, two hit points, you know, he'd have two willpower, one attack if Dane's on the board, which if you're running dwarves, somebody's running him. So, yeah, it's a good card. I'm totally with you on the Fall of Gil-galad. I'm really kind of mystified by that card, because all the heroes I could think of that would work, Bjorn's a great example where that would actually be a really great swing of the game to drop your threat by 12, but, oh, yeah, he can't have attachments. And it is a song, so you can go fetch it with Minstrel, sure, but at that point it begs the question of, okay, so I've got a Spirit Lore deck. Who am I sticking this on that I plan on having die? And you could say
Elrond, because he's your defender,
Suppose. See, this is what's absurd, is to make the card work, you would want it to be a high threat hero. Otherwise, it's kind of like, oh, I could stick it on Frodo and have him die and then lower my threat by 7. But that's just, I mean, hell, Galadrim's greeting on myself is 6. So, like, and you could say, oh, well, you can bring it back with Fortune or Fate. But you're talking about multiple card combo that costs you, like, 8 or 9 resources, which is just, to me, absurd. Like, that's not
even a
combo.
Yeah, I was
even
going to say the Boromir bomb would be good, but that, again, that's a discard, and he's not destroyed.
Yep. Yeah, all the different shenanigans you would want to pull, discard the hero, they don't destroy him, so...
Yeah, it's weird. I don't think I'll ever use it. Blue Mountain Trader, for me, is a way to give someone a blocker if they don't have it, and you get a resource to boot. Because you don't need to send the willpower over, because you just quest with them yourself. But Close Call,
I love Close Call. I love it.
Card.
It's good.
And again, haven't got to try it in play yet, but just from, you know, my thematic nerd perspective, I think it's great. Because not only does it... I don't know, I've been rereading the Silmarillion again, and so there's this great thought of Doom and Fate kind of chasing characters around, and so the fact that you can raise your threat to avoid getting killed is really interesting and very Tolkien-y to me.
But it's not just your
everyone's threat.
So in a solo game, absolutely, Doomed is almost like worth it every time. But in a solo game, who would you want to pay raise everyone's threat? I mean, Baragond, or maybe the...
Well, to me, that's like your eject button. That's like the big red button.
Yes, that is exactly...
Yeah, because if somebody's like... Because if you're, again, into Ithilien or something, what's really hard, you got to have somebody hanging around. Like, that's when you kind of pull the trigger on that. But I also was going to say that I like that it references the point in the books in which Frodo gets speared by the orc chieftain, which in the movies it's the cave troll. And everybody's like, oh my God, you should totally be dead. But, you know, he's left alive, which is cool.
I just find these Doom cards in multiplayer... Look, we put in the condition attachment Spirit Doom card because there's all those condition attachments, and I was running Miner of the Iron Hills, but I might never have it. So we had the Spirit guy put it in because a lot of those conditions suck. You damage a person if you draw a card or what have you. It never ended up getting played, but I don't like reactive cards. I've said it 1,000 times, I think, on our show, and this card is reactive. There's other ways to deal with it. I think that you can avoid the damage. I'm not convinced.
Yeah.
What about the Swift and Silent? Do we like that one? That one's interesting.
Do you want to say more about that one? I want to stay on Close Call for just a second, and we'll move on. In general, I agree with you. Reactive is not the right approach. The reason why I like Close Call, there's two things, and I even like it in multiplayer, is one, the fact that all the Doom have zero cost doesn't matter as much for a sphere like Leadership or even Spirit where there's... You can do Zigil Minor shenanigans or whatever, but Tactics being the by far the most resource poor sphere, zero cost at the cost of threat is actually a good deal for Tactics a lot of times. I mean, that's the whole reason why when I run Tactics, I almost always run Tactics Boromir, because I'm basically saying bring it. Like, I will raise my threat, and if I need to, I'll have the Spirit guy use Galadrim's Greeting specifically on me so that I can keep doing it, and then I will just basically say bring all comers. But Close Call plays into that strategy perfectly. And honestly, if Tactics Boromir is loaded up with Support of the Eagles and, you know, Gondorian Shield, and he's just, like, tanking everything in the game, but I get a bad shadow and no one has Hasty Stroke, do you think all the other players are going to raise their threat 2 to avoid him dying? Yes. I think everyone is going to raise their threat 2 to avoid losing the dude that's, like, tanking all the enemies in play. So, and yeah, that's a very specific example, but the whole thing is it's a tactics card. Sure. I'm sticking that in a heavy tactics deck. I'm not splashing tactics for that card because, as you said, if I have Spirit, I'm running Hasty Stroke. If I have Lore, I'm running a Burning Brand. The reason why I'm using that card is I'm probably running either mono tactics or heavy tactics, and I need, as Derek called it so eloquently, an eject button. I need an oh crap, my hero's about to die, is everyone cool raising their threat by one or two? To not have me lose a hero.
I hear you, but I'm never going to use it. Never. Well, I shouldn't say never, but I'm never going to use it because, look, if that, I was about to swear uncontrollably, if this card is in my hands and I cannot use it, if that's the draw that I make, I will be pissed off because this is not the draw that's going to win me the game. This is the, oh crap, I'm losing, let me lose a little bit less. I'd rather draw behind strong walls. Let me ready him and then get an extra defense. Or let me pay the one resource from my leadership deck to transfer the Dunedain card that boosts defense.
It's not the defense boosting that I'm worried about, though, honestly, because you're like Boromir with support of the Eagles, nothing is getting through that. Even a chaining shadow card, like I easily get Boromir to like 8 or 9 defense, and if someone has Arwen, he'll have like 10. It's just ridiculous. So it's not the defense, it's the shenanigan shadow cards where it's like do direct damage to the defender, or the, you know, just the weird stuff where like he ends up, because he's my highest threat hero, with some crazy condition attached.
But is that worth keeping minor around? You know, using the specific Boromir example, is close call even worth putting in your deck with Gundorian Discipline around?
That is a very fair point, and I do use Gundorian Discipline in that deck, and I love it because he's the guy that's getting all the hate, and so if anyone's taking damage of my heroes, it's most likely going to be Boromir. So, I mean, you make a fair point there. I guess the other thing that I was going to say about Close Call, though, and then we'll move on to other cards, is it isn't just your heroes, so you can actually use it to bail out somebody else.
What do you mean? It says cancel X damage.
A hero, not your hero.
Yeah, a hero. It doesn't say a hero you control.
I see what you're saying. Not
you. So, like, you something bad happens to you. You're about to lose a hero. I play the card. We all raise our threat, but I just saved your hero.
Yeah, and that could be handy, too, with the, because, you know, every once in a while, the spirit deck ends up having to take one on the chin, and Eowyn or somebody has to defend. Yep. So, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. And honestly, there's no phase restriction on it either. It's just a response. So, like, Eowyn's questing and some terrible when revealed comes up, have no cancellation, it's going to kill Eowyn. I think every player is going to take the 2 threat bump or, you know, whatever it was that would have killed her.
Close call, Eowyn.
No, that's true. It's not a combat action like tactics or feint or what have you. I mean, I agree. I just don't like the kind of cards that sit in my hand. Now, granted, there will there be instances that I'm like, damn, I wish I had close call. Sure. But by and large, I see this as a card in a very limited 50-card deck sitting in my hand 9 times out of 10.
It's not a 3-of. To me, it's a 2-of and only in a deck that, like, in certain decks. But I don't think it's useful. And that's in contrast to the more that I have tried out the other Doomed cards, Doomed player cards, I don't like most of them, honestly. Yeah. I really think they don't give you all that. Like, the worst to me is Deep Knowledge. Like, that card, I just probably will never play.
Doom 4 is a lot. I mean, it's a powerful effect for sure.
Well, no. Deep Knowledge is Doom 2, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, is that the
but,
draw
But
card?
It's draw 2 cards, and out of a sphere that has, like, I don't know, 15 better ways to draw 2 cards.
Well, but it's the fact that everyone gets
sure. What was the next card we were going to talk about?
Swift and Silent.
Yeah, I like it. And I like that it's a secrecy card without being secrecy. And I think, you know, I think it was the article announcing the release of this pack that talked about how it's handy and that it provides you cheap, repeatable readying that's not unexpected courage or fast hitch. So as long as you're keeping the threat low, it's good, and it's, I don't know, because my favorite secrecy card is Sam, so, and usually I'll pair him with Glorfindel or somebody like that, but just having that in there is super nice without having to worry about having to stretch your spheres out or splash to get something else.
I mean, certainly there's the zero cost cram that does
but
the
then
same
that's gone.
Thing.
Or it gets washed, or it gets stolen by some. Then it gets stolen by some Dunlendings.
Stolen by some Dunlendings. You can't. They can't steal
true.
Events.
But, right.
Well, no,
it'll
go back to your hand
because.
Well,
if you're secrecy, if you're not secrecy, then no.
It's funny that you mentioned Sam. Sam was a beast in Dunland Trap because with all the crazy engagement stuff, like a lot of times he was questing for 4, which is awesome.
Good old Samwise.
You know, like
I think it's an interesting card. I don't dislike it. Again, I'm not sure I'd put it in deck for anything because it's like, well, there's other things
I can do.
Well,
we keep coming back to that, but are they, I mean, is it possible that they're even throttling the cards? Because you look at Knife Guide, that's a cool card, but it's two cost to for a one-time effect.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, it's...
I would put that card in, I don't know, but my thought was like, when we get to this card, I'm going to say that I'd put this in any damn deck.
She's good.
I don't care if it's silver or not.
She's
because,
good.
But then I'm like, wait a minute. Which heroes would I want to quest with that they don't exhaust? Tactics, for sure. Because you get your one, they're one or two, which you would never have otherwise. But like A1, obviously, she doesn't defend well, she doesn't attack well. So you're not going to use this for her.
But there's...
Elrond's a great... He's a great one because he defends
we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Well.
I want to talk about Swift and Silent.
Sorry, I thought we were done.
It goes to actually the whole topic of this pack though is that I look at this card and this card so totally is about the Sylvan archetype to me, right? Because you're talking about low threat. There's going to be more Sylvan heroes. We know that for a fact. They've mentioned it. We don't know who they're going to be, but probably Spirit Glorfindel will be in there because he finds his way into every secrecy deck because his starting threat's so, you know, ridiculously low.
Yeah.
But that said, it's not the end of the world thematically to have a Noldor in your Sylvan deck. My point is, you look at this card, like, if you're just using it as spot readying, Kram is better. 99% of the time, Kram is better. But I look at this card, it's an event, it returns to your hand. There's, like, kind of a theme here with, like, playing stuff and having things return to your hand. I have a sneaking suspicion that Sylvan decks are going to have ways to get events. We'll see, but, you know,
we
like...
We know that. We've seen it. They've the French spoiler showed the whichever card... The forums have been talking about this. There's the one card that in the English article, we couldn't see her text. But in the French article, we could see her text, and they've translated it. So we do know that there is an... Yeah, we do know that there's a card that
brings
back events.
Whereas dwarves with, like, Erebor Hammersmith are interacting with, you know, with attachments, and then interacting with attachments in your discard. You know, elves are going to, like, it looks like, you know, between the songs and then the events, the ability to fetch events, you're going to, that's kind of like the direction elves are going to go. So this is a Sylvan card, and I can see, you know, your question of, like, oh, would I put this in their decks? Probably not, but I don't think it was made for all decks, and I think we're at a point in the card pool.
Yeah, it's a secrecy card.
Well, it's
secrecy. It's a Sylvan card?
Yeah. I can see it being a secrecy card. I can also see it being a Sylvan card.
How is it a Sylvan card?
So,
me,
I, and Derek and I were talking about this actually before we started the recording, is that...
Yeah.
You're gonna run Celeborn if you're running a Sylvan deck. He is the hero that you run, that you build your deck around. Totally think that by the end of this, there will be a viable Sylvan secrecy deck. Probably two heroes. It will be two heroes. But so this card starts to make a whole lot more sense at that point because you basically are saying like, okay, I'm down a hero, I'm losing action advantage there, but oh, I get one of these. Well, now I'm using and Celeborn's stats are really freaking good. So now either Nathguide's having him quest without exhausting, or I'm using this to have him, you know, essentially quest and then ready. You're getting the action advantage back that you lose from only having two heroes. You're using Resourceful. I probably will build that deck with Steward of Gondor, which, granted, is not thematic.
Slave
to the
Lord.
You're using leadership. Exactly. But
Steward of Elfdor.
Steward of, you know, King of the Elves or whatever the hell you want to call it. And so you get some resource advantage. That makes up for the loss of the hero there. If you get the action advantage, you make up for the loss there. Two hero, secrecy, Sylvan deck gives you the time to start to kind of get set up. All this stuff like Tree People, if you know, if your other hero is lore or if you're using songs or whatever, is going to allow you to get, like, you basically drop a Sylvan Refugee and then Tree People that thing into a Haldir or an Orophin or a whatever his other, you know, crazy brothers are named. Like, you're going to be able to
I'm
do...
excited for that card.
Timely Aid, same thing. You're going to be able to do ally mustering to get bigger, more useful Sylvan allies into play. Like, I think that's an archetype.
Yeah.
I really do. And Leaf Broach is another one that just kind of like telegraphs it, right? Like, we're seeing these things. There's going to be a whole archetype around elves and low threat.
That's true.
Let's go back to Nathguide for a second. So, again, it's we're saying it's not something you're going to put in every single deck, but it's a pretty good card.
I think you could.
Yeah, I think you could.
Honestly, I mean, if you're running leadership, because again, as I said a moment ago, that your tactics heroes that have willpower but you never use it, she's great.
Yeah, and
for
I guess
that.
Thinking more multiplayer.
Because
yeah.
again, it's choose a right. hero. It's not your hero. It's any hero. And so,
yeah,
I
even think she's good with Eowyn, honestly, because when you look at over the course of the game, there are quite a few scenarios now where you need to do some kind of a escape test, or a hide
yeah.
test, or a call. Pick some word here for the verb. But basically, what it is it's right. out of the normal quest phase. At some other point, you're making a willpower-based test. Well, Nath Guide plus Eowyn against Hyde test, I think that's pretty good.
Yeah.
I agree. I think this card, certainly great for Sylvan, because then Celeborn's questing for three. Who knows what other Sylvan heroes we'll get. But I think she could fit in almost any deck, certainly multiplayer, because there's plenty of heroes you want to hold back, but they're going to have one or two or three willpower that you never would have had otherwise. So yeah. it can be beneficial, for sure.
Well, speaking of the Lord of the Galathrim, what do we think about Celeborn? I mean, so the Sylvan are kind of like the wayward kid brothers of the Noldor. So Celeborn isn't nice. Going to be an Elrond, but he's still really stinking good.
My wager is, because again, this is the first cycle designed by Caleb and Matt, this is what they probably wish Dane Ironfoot
yeah,
was
yeah, yeah.
back at the end of Return to Mirkwood, is my guess. If they could go back and do Dane, this is what
this
Dane
is.
Would be.
This is who Dane yeah. should have been.
Well, this
highly,
is what I mean in, when I say the word throttling, in that like you had these crazy explosions of powerful cards in the Dwarves and in Outlands and so on. So maybe they're being a little bit more discerning in the way they're designing these cards, because Celeborn, like you just said, is the Dine of the Sylvan, but he's not quite as powerful. It's just a little bit more under control.
It's going to be more fun
yeah.
to play, honestly, too, because when you look at the effect, yeah. like it's all about like bouncing stuff and you know things coming into play. It's in the you look at tree people and it's like, oh, I'm going to swap a Sylvan refugee for Haldir, and Haldir is going to come in as a 3/3/3. Mm-hmm. That's pretty freaking
yeah.
good. Like. Yeah. With ranged and sentinel, and maybe if I do a Nath guide, you know, or Nath guide's only hero, but I do some kind of readying like the Swift and Silent, or Swift and Silent only heroes too. Whatever, I do some kind of readying effect, and I get a 3/3/3 with ranged and sentinel that's doing two actions. Like, that's pretty yeah. awesome.
Yeah, I tried to make a deck for him around him this weekend. The problem was, and I might have said this earlier in the episode, I don't recall. Maybe it was pre-show. There's just
yeah,
not enough.
Absolutely.
It's like, all right, I'm only getting a boost for one round.
Yeah.
And Tree People's only three cards. There's Children of the Sea, but Children of the Sea is Spirit, and it was going to be Celeborn, Merlond of all freaking heroes, and Elrond.
Those
are
so happy
heroes.
Hearing you willingly say that name.
Although, honestly, once I thought about it, I was like, I don't need other Sylvan heroes, because not enough affects heroes. I could have just had him in Sylvan allies, and the other heroes could have been whatever. But it was going to be him, Merlond, and
Biffer
Elrond.
Is the one, if you're yeah. not a slave to theme, that I would go with, because it just works. Like, low threat, really great ability
right.
for being able... Because, honestly,
right.
most, like, 80% of the good Sylvan allies that don't cost one or two are lore.
Yeah.
You know, there's like yeah. there's like a handful now of good lore Sylvan allies that you would want to do the shenanigans with, and that have good enough stats that when they get with Celeborn's bonus, they're actually really impressive at that point.
Well,
but,
yeah, the Sylvan tracker is a no-brainer if you're running Sylvan. So.
Yes, yes. I totally agree with you guys. We're not there yet. That doesn't concern me at all. This is the first pack of the cycle.
Yeah. Yeah, well, again, it goes back to my earlier point with Steward's Fear. Outlands was ready to go with just the one pack, plus there was the one Outlands.
But that's
in the
because it's a four sphere deck that somehow is playable out of one sphere, which is silly.
This one, they've chosen to distribute the cards more evenly, which is probably better in a way. And so I think he will be a great hero. Again, I'm not really a theme player, so I don't care if I'm playing elves or dwarves or a mixture of races in Middle Earth. But I suspect that he's a type of hero that I will play more often than some of the other strictly more like hobbit heroes where you have to have other hobbits. I like having a mixture of things.
One thing that I will point out as well that for people that aren't maybe theme players or just want to try different decks, I think his stats are good enough for his starting threat that you could put him in a deck with no Sylvans, and that is
yeah.
three willpower out of leadership.
Yeah.
Yeah, 11 threat kind of sucks, but I mean, honestly, like, let's say you did a heavy, like, here's an example of a deck that I think would be really interesting. Your heroes would be Celeborn, Sam Gamgee, and Tactics Boromir, right?
Huh.
For someone who's, and bear in mind, this is not thematic at all, but you just want to win, like, I'm questing for six turn one, And depending on the threat of the enemy, if I'm optionally engaging, I'm readying Sam, and I have two guys ready to deal with whatever comes up. Like, that's that's bonkers good. And two leadership heroes, you're sticking Steward on, you know, potentially Boromir turn one, and you're dumping a bunch of crazy good tactic stuff. So, I mean, that deck would be pretty freaking good and has nothing at all to do with elves.
Yeah, I agree. He's a good hero.
As he should be. And that's something they've figured out how to do, is to take these iconic characters, uber powerful characters, and make them really fit the game really well in multiple scenarios, which, you know, we can't even get into Galadriel in this episode, but she's going to be one that's really, really worth talking about. But well, any final thoughts on the Dunlin Trap or player cards and counter cards, anything at all before we wrap this special edition up?
As with any cycle, I think it's hard to, because cycles are developed as a whole, they're designed as a whole, so it's hard to know exactly. The cards were like, oh god, Fall of Gil-galad, maybe it's horrible, but who knows what we're going to get that will make it that much better, or Blue Mountain Trader, or we didn't speak much about White Council, though I kind of like it on the surface. It's so hard to judge a cycle with its first pack. So I'm certainly curious to see where we head. The quest is fun. I want to play it a few more times. I always like fighting non-orc enemies. So that in and of itself, I think, makes the quest more fun. And so I definitely can't wait to see what the next
five
months brings.
You're going to get more non-orcs. I promise you that.
I'm with you, Matthew, as well. I think this is a really promising thing, and especially going ahead with the knowledge that this is just one part of the whole. And especially with everything that's been spoiled so far, I'm really I feel very confident about the Ringmaker cycle. I'm excited about it.
So my my final thought is, and it's good to see the on the FFG forums people have been talking about this too, that I am one of the handful of people that's very excited to see Secrecy get some love again. I think it's insanely underrated as a whole in the community, and I think it's a fun archetype, and I'm excited to see what else comes out for it.
Yeah, if you're gonna create a keyword, it needs the support. And if one cycle can't do it, then revisit it in another cycle. Whether I like Secrecy or not is irrelevant. I'm excited to see it get more attention.
Okay. All right, well, thank you for listening to this special edition of the Grey Company podcast. We'll be back soonish with another full episode with the full complement of the Grey Company, including Ian, and who knows, maybe we'll get his baby to make an appearance as well. Chime in on the Ringmaker cycle. But as always, you can find us in many places on the interwebs. You can check out our blog, which houses most of these episodes at greycompanypodcast.wordpress.com. We are on Facebook and Twitter. And as always, you can send us an email at thegreycompanypodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon. Good night.
Congratulations, Ian.
Congrats, Ian.